this morning.
Morning. Open the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. Paul, if someone could grab that door.
And there goes the Secretary of State.
Whizzing by. So we'll do 9:54 first. That should be quick and easy. Actually, we're going to do 10:27 second, because we just need to move that down to Ways and Means. So that should be hopefully very quick. If you've signed up on 10:27, or Senator Metzger, I just asked, Laura, are you talking on okay, we don't need much, because we're just going to send it down to Ways and Means. And then we'll do look at 518 and 10:47, and then do 808 and 609. We may try to work 808 if it's all ready to go into the mix. Open a work session on Senate Bill 954. Paul, we got the amendment around noon yesterday.
Mr. Chair, I think everybody's seen the amendment. Just to remind you, we talked about it at the meeting yesterday. The Dash 5 amendment changes a couple of things from the Dash 4. First of all, on line 6, section 2, on page 1 there, it inserts the word following each tax year. So we were concerned about the start date, whether it would be interpreted as starting with 2009 and therefore having an effect in this biennium. So that makes it clear that while it applies to the 2009 tax year, it's the transfer is made following the conclusion of that year. So those numbers will be known, and then the transfer takes place in the spring of 2010 for the first transfer. The other more substantive change is right at the end of the amendment on page 4, section 6. The original bill, as we interpreted it, would have applied to existing projects. And, of course, the SIP program has been around for a good while. So the new sub 2 there of section 6 refers to projects that become eligible for the exemption from taxation under the SIP statute on or after January 1, 2008. So 2009 would be the first year you do the calculation following that year, and it'd have to be an agreement that had been reached and executed after January 1, 2008. And the revenue impact from that change is significant for 09-11. You saw that yesterday. It means the 09-11 impact on the general fund is about $600,000. Those dollars, of course, go into the shared services fund. And then in 11-13, we're estimating about $4.5 million available to transfer through the shared services fund.
Questions from Paul?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 954.
Senator George has moved the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 954. Discussion. Objections to that motion. So, Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, is this headed to Ways and Means, or is this headed to the floor?
To the floor.
To the floor with a due pass recommendation.
That's to be part of the motion.
To rescind. So can you make, as part of your motion, rescinding the referral to Ways and Means?
Okay, yes. Because I said that, or because we had it previously? Okay, did we move that previously?
Paul? We have not. I don't believe
okay, because I just asked a question. I hadn't actually moved
no. The bill, as it is now, has a subsequent to Ways and Means. If you want to ask the Senate President to rescind that, that has to be part of the motion.
Okay.
And that's because it does not have any impact in this biennium.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Not until the 09-11 biennium, so it really shouldn't need to go to Ways and Means.
And I did talk to the Senate President's office. Now it's foggy and 2 weeks old, but I did talk to the Senate President's office about having that that referral, at least the committee asking for that referral to be rescinded.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, as a reminder, the Senate President, it's still on his call. I mean, you're requesting that it be removed.
No, no. Mm-hmm. When we ask, it, have a batting lineup around.
Mr. Chairman, I move the amended with Dash 5, Senate Bill 954, be sent to the President's desk with a request that it not be sent to Ways and Means, but be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is that close enough, Paul?
That'll do.
Okay.
That'll do. discussion of Senator George's motion to move 954 to the floor with the DuPass recommendation, also rescinding the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Any objections to that motion? So ordered.
Washington County gets whatever they want.
Close the work session on 954, and that's a bill of statewide importance and
yes,
statewide significance and applies everywhere in the state. I'll carry the bill. Open a... If we could get 1027 in, let's try to get 1027 in real quick here. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1027. Anyone here to testify on 1027? Please come up. And Laura Lockwood McCall, do you want to join? You're here on the dash too. Great. We'll have the panel for the bill, and then we'll have the treasurer's office following.
Chair Deckard, members of the committee, my name is Michael McKelvey. I'm the executive director at the Port of Hood River. It's good to be here in front of you. Hood River is presented with an extraordinary opportunity right now. As many of you may know, the Hood River waterfront has languished for many years. Much of it is zoned light for light industry, and we are presented with the opportunity to locate existing businesses that need to expand on the Hood River waterfront. What we're in need of is critical infrastructure to do that, and we have handouts in front of you that show the interest of the various companies that are growing and expanding in our community that need to stay in our community, and it's an area that has a significant lack of light industrial zone property. So the Hood River waterfront is just about the only place where these companies can expand. So you see Maritime Services, Hood River Distillers, the Hood River Juice Company, the Kine. These are companies that are headquartered in Hood River that are growing and need room to expand. We have a place for them. We have a plan, and we have good community support, but we need a state support and infrastructure. We don't expect the state to go it alone. We have a plan that would have the port coming up with $1 million, the companies or other sources with $2 million, and we believe the gap, the critical gap that we need funded and filled is $2 million from the state. So I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 1027 and urge your passage of it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Bill Fashing, Hood River County Economic Development Coordinator. I'll be brief. I'm here on behalf of Hood River County expressing our support for Senate Bill 1027. And Michael did not mention, but we had forwarded a couple of amendments to Senator Metzger, and I'm not sure if those have gotten to this committee yet or not, and so I guess I just leave that on the table for your consideration.
We don't have them.
Okay, I was afraid.
That's from the treasurer's office. Yeah. Well, committee, what I've agreed to do, lottery bonds are an area that we're going to be, I think, pretty conservative with this session, and so you're attached to a bonding source that I just think the legislature is going to be pretty circumspect around how aggressive we are. But to get you into the right committee, to what I've agreed, committee is to keep this moving.
To Ways and Means.
To Ways and Means. After we hear from the treasurer's office.
Okay.
Questions for this panel.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just real quickly, one of the issues I know from bonds is to make sure that the bonds proceeds get spent within the specific period of time. I don't know if that's what these amendments do, but I guess the question is, you get the money, you got a plan to spend it relatively quickly.
We can be under construction next spring. Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Laura Lockwood McCall.
Good morning, members of the committee. Laura Lockwood McCall from the Office of State Treasurer's Office. We have dash two amendments that have been drafted and prepared in combination with the Department of Justice staff. Primarily, they're technical in nature, but I will point out what we did, which was section five of the bill is some language that was in a previous lottery bond bill from several years ago for a different type of project. And what it says is if we haven't issued bonds by a certain drop-dead date, then we take just lottery revenues. And it was for a specific project that was the way that the language was crafted to make sure the money was funded. However, if you read section four of the bill, it says that the Department of Economic Development Director has to make a determination whether all the funds necessary to complete the project are in place prior to the sale of the bonds. So there's a little logical inconsistency. And so assuming that the legislature didn't intend for that logical inconsistency, what we tried to do was carve out Section 5 and just clarify that during the biennium beginning July 1st, 2007, we may issue these bonds if the other funds are in place.
Questions for the Treasurer's Office? Thank you very much. Closed hearing, open a work session on Senate Bill 1027.
We want to add the dash twos before we send it down there.
Okay. I think that would be
move the
helpful.
Dash two down, sir.
Senator George has moved the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 1027. Discussion. Objections. Senator George.
Now, the motion is to move Senate Bill 1027 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommendation.
I think no recommendation would be. You're more than welcome to, however you want to phrase it.
I think they have a need out there, and that was what we'd hoped the lottery was going to do. So I'll just bring it out as that being part of the motion as a DUPRAT pass, and we can have a discussion.
Okay, so Senator George has amended his motion to make it a due pass to move 1027 with a due pass to Ways and Means discussion.
Yeah, I'd prefer to move it with no recommendation. There are so many needs. There are so many demands on lottery bonding, and Ways and Means Committee is going to have to sort through those very carefully and weigh them, weigh each need. This is certainly a project that has merit, but then there are a lot of other needs for lottery bonding that have merit as well, and so I can't vote with a recommendation.
Yeah, just for the folks from Hood River, I do think this has got an uphill climb down, just because it wasn't really teed up, at least in my discussions on lottery bonding, just wasn't teed up going in, but I'm happy to get them in the game. I hope, I'm not sure if our due pass or non-due pass is going to be determinative and in that. So I'm happy to support it if we want to have a no vote on that.
Yeah, you better count as a no vote.
Okay. So Senator George has moved Senate Bill 1027 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee with the due pass. Barbara.
Senator Bray.
Excuse.
Senator George.
Aye.
Senator McGill.
No.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Dennis.
Votes aye. Motion carries. Close the work session on Senate Bill 1027. Open a work session on Senate Bill 518. Thanks, Mazin, for all the help on that. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. You have before you dash one amendments to Senate Bill 518, and then also you have some suggested revisions for the dash one amendments. We did not get those amendments until late on the 7th, and it took all day yesterday to review those. And the governor's office and Ms. Pinwell reviewed them very closely and have some suggested revisions, but I would suggest that they are so they're relatively minor in nature, and given it takes so darn long to get amendments, up from LC because they're so busy. I would hope if you're inclined to move the bill that we can just move the bill and it's in it with the dash one, get the amendments drafted, and take care of those technical things in the House, because Representative Barnhart's ready to receive the bill if we send it over. He was on the work group. Let me tell you a little background. You recall the last time we were here, we had John Hottinger, the former senator from Minnesota, here testifying about this program in the state of Minnesota. Senator Starr expressed an interest and did participate in at least one work group. And what I found most difficult about this concept was it was a big, huge concept to get our hands around. And my head was kind of spinning a little bit in the work group, and I was just getting a little bit nutty about it because we were having a tough time focusing on how broad to make it. So what we did, I had called in the governor's office. Tim McCabe, the governor's economic development policy advisor, came into the work group, replaced the Oregon Economic Community Development Department, and participated very fully and thoroughly and offered up some suggestions. And we have now limited this bill to only those programs through the department, Oregon Economic Community Development Department. That captures much of what I have angst about, for instance, enterprise zones and a number of other programs, and you'll see those listed on page 2 of the Dash 1 amendments. And these are things that the governor's office is actually, Mr. McCabe said, these are questions that I want answered from the department. So he's actually quite thrilled that we're doing this. I shared these with Senator Betsy Johnson, who has OECDD's budget in her subcommittee. She was excited about these amendments. She's excited about this bill because we find that we don't get the kind of information that we need. My goal was to show what we get for the money. Senator Starr, I believe, if I can represent his position, believes these programs are quite beneficial and wants us to, is hopeful that what we're going to do here is show the benefits. I'm hoping that we show that we don't get all the benefits that we expect, or actually, I don't really care one way or the other whether we do or we don't, but what I want to know is the answer. If we benefit from the program, great. Let's expand on it. Let's use it. Let's continue to support these kinds of programs. If we're not getting the bang for the buck that we're putting into it, then let's, you know, cut our losses and move on. And that's what we're asking here. You will see in the Dash 1 amendments, we take you through and list all the programs that we believe need to be captured. The suggested revisions to the amendment takes out three of those programs that are not administered under OECDD, and that would be on page 2, lines 20 through 22 of the amendments. Those programs are not administered through the department, so we would delete those. The program, the data that we're asking is to list all of the programs, the amount of state funds that are budgeted for each program, the performance data, which will be developed by rule by the department, and then what we have achieved for that. And by that, I mean this is the guts and the meat of the bill, Mr. Chair. When we get over to page 4, we want to know about all of the information, the employment information. We want to know the number of full-time employees, part-time employees, the number of employees employed in jobs created by this participant, and we will add an amendment as a result of the incentive program or fund, the number of employees retained in their jobs, the temporary positions that we have, the number of jobs that were filled by Oregon workers. Now, that's one little slot the governor's office and I disagree about. They don't believe that should be in there. I was sort of looking to keep that in there, but that can be another discussion for another day. But what I was hoping to find out here is, are we giving money away to bring in a company or expand a company only to have them bring workers from out of state, or are we investing in our own workers? There's some issue about whether it's constitutional to be asking that question. But the other things that we ask are the average annual wage, the estimated average hourly wage, and the median income for the area, whether they provide health care benefits to their employees, and because many of us are concerned that we give away tax money, tax incentives, and then the employees end up signing up for the health plan because they don't get health benefits. So we want to know if that's being provided. We also want to know if they have leveraged any private investment in the project or facility, which they often do. So the state funds help leverage private funds. I get that. I understand it, but I want to see it. I want that information provided to the people of the state of Oregon, and particularly us as legislators who are overseeing these programs through the department's budget. We also want to know the estimated personal income tax revenue of the jobs created.
Can we pause just on those? And maybe this is a question for Paul. Just want to make sure that in those provisions that it's not too Herculean of a task to derive the derivative revenue of when you incent a large or medium-sized traded sector firm. How easy is that for economists to quantify all of, I guess, the previous two portions of that Senator Walker mentioned?
Mr. Chair, there may be some collection issue with some of the others, but the sub F, the estimated personal income tax revenue, that's similar to Senate Bill 954. What you're really doing is if you're looking at the number of jobs and the average wage per job, we have an average tax rate for that. So I would see this not as trying to actually count the dollars, but rather to make an estimate based on the effective tax rate for that average wage. Mm-hmm. So I think that could be done in a straightforward way.
Pretty straightforward.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we did have the Department of Revenue participate in the work group, and they expressed some objections to the initial bill, wondering how they were going to be able to facilitate all this. But I believe the way we are now, we are fine. And Ms. Penwell was quite helpful in our work group representing the Association of Oregon Counties. We had the League of Oregon Cities represented as well. People are just very excited about how we've narrowed it and the kind of information that we're asking for. So those are the things that we want to know, and the governor's office wants to know those kinds of things about the programs that we administer. Mr. McCabe was not able to be here today, but told me I was able to represent it with the revisions. If we make the revisions to the amendment, they're happy with the bill. They're very excited about it, actually. And I'm quite thrilled that the governor's office is as interested as I am, and I think other legislators are, about where our money goes and what we're getting for our tax incentive programs. Like I said before, I'm not opposed to tax incentive programs per se. What I'm opposed to is just giving it away and not having any accountability for it. And I just feel we haven't had any. These are questions that we've never been able to get answers to. I know Senator Johnson's been frustrated in her committee getting answers from the department about these kinds of issues. So we will just set these up in statute. And I think what our goal is to start out with the department on these programs, and then if we find this successful, then expand it out next session to other tax incentive programs that are not administered by the department. And with that, that's really all I have to say. Ms. Penwell, I'd like her to make a few comments, and then if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Senator Deckert, members of the committee, I'm Doris Penwell. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I was one of the local government participants in this little work group that we had with the senator to make this reporting thing something that would actually be helpful for the governor, for the state, for everybody, for the department, frankly. In my mind, this report doesn't go too much further than what the department already has information on. It just puts the information in a different report that sort of lays it out the way people like Senator Walker would like to see the information. So as long as we can make some of the amendments that we suggested to Senator Walker and that she has talked about somewhere here in the legislative session, I think the local governments, at least the counties and, frankly, the department probably and the governor's office for sure, we can support this bill and look forward to the information that you will receive in the next reporting period.
Great. Questions for this panel?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator George.
Senator, right after the good Minnesota senator, former senator, was here, I watched a program on CNN, I think it was Lou Dobbs, and one of the things that they pointed out was that companies were coming in, utilizing our enterprise zones, foreign-owned companies, and then bringing in foreign workers under work visas. And I found that pretty amazing that here we would be, in effect, subsidizing the company to come in. That's wonderful to make the investment. But they weren't hiring Oregonians, and they weren't hiring anyone from the United States. They were bringing in primarily foreign workers under a foreign work visa. And I found that pretty alarming. And I would think that to get this kind of reporting would be an excellent idea.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator George. And that is why I differ. That's the only area that I differ with the governor's office, and I'd like a little more opportunity to discuss that issue about how many Oregon workers they're hiring, because I'm concerned about exactly the same thing you're talking about. So that's a small point of contention that I think we can resolve between now and the House hearings on this issue, should we pass it out and pass it across the Senate floor. I think that's very important to know.
Other questions for this panel? Senator Starr.
Thank you. Appreciate the work and on this, Senator. I think that it's agree with you that I think this is good information, and I think we ought to have it. I'm concerned a little bit about additional costs that this may incur on OECD and the Department of Revenue. Do you have any idea what the fiscal impact may be to those agencies?
Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, I do not. As Ms. Pinwell indicated, this is information the department already has, OECD. They have this information. They just don't provide it in a timely manner or in a manner that we can see or understand. So I frankly don't think this is a fiscal cost to the department. They just have to get their folks trained to put this information together. The Department of Revenue only has to assist the department in preparing some of these things. So I can't imagine that there's a huge fiscal attached to this at all. Of course, we haven't seen a fiscal statement, but I think these things can be absorbed in their own budget. Ms. Pinwell used to work at the department.
Is anyone from the department here?
I don't know what the fiscal
impact is. Can't do that. Karen Nelson, while she comes up, we're going to do your bill next. I know you have a lot of folks who travel the distance to be here, and we'll make sure we do that one next.
For the record, I'm Ann Hannes, Acting Manager at Community Development Division at OECD. I don't have that information about the fiscal impact at this time, so we'll provide that to you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr.
I believe Senator Walker mentioned that the department would have to do a rulemaking in order to accomplish this. I think that's what he said. And if that's the case, there should be some underlying kind of boilerplate cost, at least for a minor rulemaking.
Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, the rulemaking is for their performance data. That's what it directs them in the bill to develop their performance measures by rule. That I don't believe is a huge fiscal, and it's actually something they should have done a long time ago.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? So we'll, Senator Walker, we'll wait and we'll get the new amendment.
Would you like me to have the revision made up?
Yeah.
So the dash one?
Yeah, whatever changes that folks are looking for. I think we've been really reluctant, very reluctant, only on one occasion, to pass something out that we don't fill.
I feel the same way, Mr. Chair. Oh. I'm just concerned about the time in the session, but I'm willing to do that and ask Janelle down in LC if we can get this expedited. She was out ill, and that's why we I had a little bit of delay.
Okay, so you'll get the...
I'll get a dash two.
Dash two drafted and Senator Stark.
Yeah, I don't think the amendment's going to change the bill much. I'd like to see kind of if we can get a fiscal impact back on the dash ones. I think that would be helpful to have that at the same time.
To get a sense from the department can take a look at, or basically take the dash ones and whatever changes are being agreed to, include those in and get some sort of fiscal analysis or at least some sense for us of what this would do to the department. We want the department out focused on finding the next traded sector company and not spend too much time internally getting us good information that we need, that we want. But I'd hate to tie you up too much where we want the eyes to be, which is what are the opportunities for Oregon. Yes, Senator George.
Pretty good economic development to answer that. Do we track anything like that? If we support bringing in a company, we solicit someone, they come in, they establish the company, and then they bring in foreign workers under special work visa to operate those facilities. Do we track that kind of thing?
Sure, Dr. Senator George, I'm not sure about that. I do know that we do track the number of jobs that are created for each project, but I don't know the question regarding foreign employment. And I don't know how difficult that is to capture that information.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah, please.
CNN was able to do it, and they were coming in almost $20,000 a year under American workers in the same position. I think it's a really important issue.
I mean, the firms I'm familiar with would pay. I mean, I'm thinking HP1 visas and others, but maybe these are not the norm. They tend to be higher, or the ones I've seen are higher, and at least on enterprise zones and SIPs, I think you can get that data. I mean, SIPs is just obvious. They come, you see the jobs on the ground pretty regularly. Enterprise zones might be a little more digging, but...
Chair, I simply don't know, and we'll have to...
I think Ms. Penwell has something to say.
I'd like to just say, Doris Penwell from AOC, I'd just like to say that anytime anybody's employed here, they have to pay Oregon taxes, whether they're Oregonians or whatever. I mean, that said, I think most of the criticism comes during, like, the construction phase when you're putting in a facility. And unfortunately, that isn't really part of the, quote, Enterprise Zone program or maybe some others. But it is something that you get criticism about from time to time. The Enterprise Zone program used to require that you employ people from the local area, but it was declared unconstitutional to have that kind of a provision. And it's especially hard for a community that's, for instance, on the border with Washington or California or whatever. It's not within the state. So they try to do first source agreements for the jobs once the facility starts operating. But I think this construction period is where the issue comes up as much as anything. So I don't know how you deal with that. It's something maybe legislators need to talk more about.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, those are issues that we've wrestled with in transportation, and we've moved these big transportation projects. And you know, we want to put Oregonians back to work. Mm-hmm. But the same thing. You got Oregon companies that want to do work in Washington, and so you have to be real careful about. Kind of garden your own, and then you got businesses that want to do business in Washington, and if Washington did the same thing, you know, you have a problem. So,
no, I mean, some of the biggest transportation and other projects we've just landed have been out of state. I could see how that's can be dangerous. So we'll wait.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Mr. Warner has the revisions to the dash one. So if he combines those with the dash one and provides those to LFO, we should be able to get a fiscal, because the only change at all from the revisions would be whether we can delete that portion or not about Oregon workers, and that's not a significant change. So I think we're good to go on finding out what we can get for a fiscal on this. But I just, while I appreciate that you think the department should be out busy giving money and recruiting the traded sector, I think the department also needs to be very careful about making sure we have accountability for that money. And that's really what I'm asking for here. Pretty simple thing, actually.
Perhaps we can marry the two.
Okay.
Perhaps. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 518. And, so Senator Nelson, I do want to because we have folks that have come a distance for Senate Bill 609, but two of us are going to be on the steps of the Capitol here in about 4 minutes, including myself. So the only thing I would hate to do is to leave your folks with three members of a committee. It's up to you. Or you.
Are there capable people? Have them come up and testify. That would be good.
Or we could have you in 30 minutes. It's up to if you'd rather have a full committee here. I'm always just.
I'd rather have a full committee 30 minutes.
If that's okay.
Do you want to recess,
or do you want to do 10:47?
Okay.
So 10:47.
Well, what do you want to do? Okay, it's probably kind of possible. Work session.
You can work 8:08 if you want.
Okay. All right. Let's go ahead. Carry the bullet. We'll wait for you to get back there.
Well,
so,
then
hurry. All right, so 10:47.
10:47.
Get out on the steps with my protest sign.
Say again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. You've been provided two documents with regard to Senate Bill 1047. Senate Bill 1047 started out as Senate Bill 696, and it got stuck in a committee and was supposed to come over to you and didn't get posted on the agenda, so I had to do the long way around and draft a priority bill. Senate Bill 1047 would authorize the state treasurer to issue Article 11D bonds to fund renewable energy. Well, actually, what it would do is put money into an bond administration fund and renewable energy fund in the treasurer's office, and it authorizes those bond proceeds or interest to be deposited in funds and expended to finance state acquisition and operation of renewable energy, electricity generation facilities, and transmission facilities. Let me give you a little background, if I might, and then I'm going to have Mr. Greeny speak to this bill. I have provided you with an opinion from Legislative Council. It should be at your desk there. I had asked about this in the interim. Article 11D is a little known section of the Oregon Constitution that has actually never been utilized. It was passed by the people of this state on November 8, 1932. I will repeat that. You have a copy of Article 11D at your desk as well that I provided for you. What the goal was to make sure that the state could own hydroelectric power facilities and generate electricity. Well, the people of the state of Oregon thought that was a grand idea, but they never really did anything with it. And I'd like to utilize that little-known section of the Oregon Constitution to invest in my goal here is to invest in transmission lines or whatever else that we may deem appropriate through general obligation bonds. The opinion that you see from Legislative Council tells you that the use of the funding must be limited to facilities operated by the state. So this is not a loan program to private entities. It is a program for state-owned facilities. The opinion will also tell you that while Article 11D largely addresses hydropower, at least three provisions in Article 11D use much broader language that distinguish between water power and electric energy. So my question to the Legislative Council was whether debt instruments could be issued for developing alternative energy sources such as wind, biomass, geothermal, and microhydro. And the answer I got back was that we believe that it would be valid use as long as the indebtedness is used to control, use, transmit, distribute, sell, and or dispose of electric energy. And it seems clear that all of these are technologies that I mentioned are used to generate electric energy. The borrowing authority could be used to fund development of alternative energy sources by private operations. They do not believe that could be done, as I indicated, so it must be state-owned. So let me tell you what I'm looking for. And Mr. Graney brought this to my attention. When I first brought him into my office to talk about this, and we've had conversations with the governor's office as well, we have this session made a real focus on generating alternative renewable energy. And some of that renewable energy would be, for instance, geothermal power, Christmas Valley, Klamath Falls. That area is a real hotbed for geothermal activity. Well, they're off the grid down there. You know, they're a major part of Oregon, but they're not really on the transmission grid. Mr. Greeny has enlightened me that the U.S. Air Force owns some transmission lines in Christmas Valley that they're willing to not use anymore, that they're willing to enter into some negotiation with, maybe abandon those or sell them to the state. My guess is they would be likely to abandon those. Article 11D allows us to work with other states within our own state and with the federal government to provide this electricity generation. This is a perfect example of taking control over those transmission lines, operating them by the state, getting that renewable energy on the grid, and moving it out to be used across the state. You can also sell your energy off the grid, which we do frequently. But that's the goal here, and that's why this bill was to be moved to Finance and Revenue, and then it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, because the funding mechanism, the governor's office still wonders how the bonds are going to be paid back and how the program would operate, and they've sort of been working with me on that a little bit, and I think we have a need for further discussion about that. But I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Graney at this point in time, if I could.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Mike Graney, Director of the Department of Energy. This bill, and Senator Walker has really highlighted a major gap in renewable energy development, and that is the transmission infrastructure. There's need for improved transmission on both the large scale and the Bonneville power system, but also in these areas, particularly in central and eastern and southeastern Oregon, where there's good solar resources, good geothermal, in some cases good wind, that are off the grid or that are have inadequate transmission to get to the major transmission areas. So funding provided by the state to acquire or upgrade transmission systems and transmission lines to fill in these gaps would fill a real need. We mentioned that because this wasn't in the governor's budget, we haven't taken a position on a funding level, but I do think it makes sense to further send the bill over to Ways and Means to, you know, further the conversation, because this is definitely a worthy need.
And, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I might add that when I served on the Clean and Diversified Energy Advisory Committee through the Western Governors Association, that was one of the three areas that we needed to improve upon was transmission. It's a problem all across the country. Bonneville's looking for some assistance to help us upgrade the transmission grid, the public, the PUDs and all the co-ops, they're all concerned about transmission. It's a huge issue. And I see this as the state providing the highway, basically, for getting that electricity out and usable, particularly if we are successful in getting a renewable energy portfolio standard established this session and people are very interested about development of alternative energy sources.
Questions? Mike, you know, I thought all along, and I'm with you, when I look at geothermal, we talked about that in the committee before, that we might actually have to take, you know, some step to intervene. In other words, the privates can't pick up what is a tentative, maybe, source. But we could, and from this particularly, like, the Christmas Valley thing. These are existing lines. Is there a lot of capacity there? Are they not being used?
Mr. Chairman, there's in Christmas Valley, which is north Lake County, there's three major lines there that the Air Force used as for a testing range. and for the infrastructure related to that. And they were simply going to tear them down because the facility is no longer being used. And those are in an area that's got good geothermal, solar, and potentially wind resources that could be, if we could keep those transmission lines and then tie them in and tie them into the main north-south and east-west grids, could open up significant resources. And many of these, some of the largest, say, wind farms, for example, the developers are able to finance transmission upgrades, but we're looking at much smaller scale resources and or greater distances that the developers involved simply don't have the ability to finance up front. And this could be a tool that either the state owns and potentially could charge and recoup over time some of its costs. So I think it's really a good opportunity for a partnership with the private sector.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe that's really, if I could go back and ask anyone who voted on that bill in 1932, that might be what they were thinking about, how to enter into this public-private partnership. This is job development. This is really job development for southeastern Oregon, I believe, and I think it's a real opportunity that we shouldn't pass up. So if you're so inclined, I'd like to see the bill moved to Ways and Means so we could try to work out the bonding authority and those mm-hmm. other issues.
Mazen, any comments? Or it went right by you when we opened this, so we're sorry about that.
Mr. Chair, it's if you were just wondering what kind of bonding capacity and stuff, I think probably the Treasurer's Office can speak to that. However, from the constitutional definitions of 1.5% of what is termed as cash value of property rather than what we these days use as either assessed value or real market value, the cash value is probably something that would be the closest to real market value. And that perhaps would give you a ceiling of somewhere around $5 billion on ability to bond up to that limit. Now, remember, with all bonding programs, it is usually the need to define what are you going to do with the proceeds before you go to bond. Rather than take the bonds and house it in an account to for purposes to be developed later. All just these things to keep in mind while you're working the bill.
Okay. Is everyone comfortable with going and sending down to Ways and Means? I think it's a good idea to look at this. Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1047, and we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1047.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 1047 to the Committee on Ways and Means. You want to do pass or you want to without?
Do you want the Treasurer's Office to say a word? I noticed that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Come on, let's hear it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to scoot down.
Okay, thank you.
Senator George, the committee, Laura Lockwood McCall from the State Treasurer's Office. I haven't been terribly involved in this so far, but I just wanted to voice my support that we're here to help create this program if this is the desire of the legislature. There may be a fiscal impact I just want to be sensitive to and aware of because it is a brand new bond program and it's energy. And so I think there could be at least a half to a one-time FTE in my office to help work with energy to develop, and obviously they'll have more program people, so that's just something else you need to consider because you can't bond in advance, and we may need some seed money for staff to really think through how to run a state power agency. And so that's something that Senator Deckard had worked on in the Oregon Community Power as well. The other things to think about as we go forward that came to mind as I listened to testimony, if it's going to be a general fund supported type of operation, and we can do that, then it will come into our debt capacity model as just one more element. And so the $5 billion number doesn't terribly make sense, but suddenly you know, the schools and the higher ed and all the other things that we look at when we think about the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission process would apply to these bonds as well. To the extent that there are revenue streams similar to, for example, the energy loan programs under Article 11J or the veterans programs, then they would be self-supporting and obviously wouldn't be subject to that same level of budgetary scrutiny. They need to still be self-supporting, and part of the reason I think there'll be a lot of work is if it is a self-supporting transaction, we'll need to work with them to develop cash flows and realistic models to make sure that the general fund doesn't get tapped, and or some sort of variation, you know, some seed money to help make sure that doesn't happen maybe in the first few years as things get up and running. Those are my initial thoughts. Thank you for the time.
Yeah, so you'd anticipate kind of like a double-barreled bond that would be paid back from the revenue from the project, backed up in a crisis by GO.
Through the chair, Senator Monroe. Yes, I think if as energy works through the cash flows and the partnerships and the revenue streams in an ideal world, that would be the best of all possible worlds, because you'd have the credit rating, which hopefully is on the ascension for the state, and we could do it in a tax-exempt way as long as we're mindful of federal tax laws regarding public versus private ownership. So we would need obviously some tax attorneys to make sure we design this program properly to get the tax exemption, and then we'd have that double barrel. Very similar, as I said, to the Veterans Loan Program, energy loan programs, et cetera. So it's a great opportunity that we already have in our Constitution to really help renewables. So I'm very excited about that. But there will be a fair amount of legal thinking and revenue finance thinking to make this a reality.
Members, yesterday in Transportation Ways and Means, we were dealing with an issue, and that was the potential loss of existing rail right-of-way. And the very concept that parallels this one came up, and that is, what do we do to preserve those? We must preserve that capacity because we know we're going to have growth. And I think it's so perfect to see this thing moving forward. I wish we had a mechanism like this for rail preservation, but we don't. So I'm comfortable, Senator, with a due pass on that motion.
That's my motion.
All right. Senator Monroe has moved that we refer Senate Bill 1047 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection to that? Okay.
Let's wait.
I'm going to close the work session then on Senate Bill 1047, and we're going to open up a what's listed as a work session on Senate Bill 808. Is that correct, Paul? Where are we going next?
Yep, that's what it says.
I'm going to ask you to tell us about this before we go forward today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 808 has been amended at the request of the advocates of the bill, which are the Multnomah County Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission and Senator Johnson, who were here previously to speak on the bill. And basically, this bill just is an update, a clarification, modifies the budget requirements for municipal entities. It allows a corporation to report on various items that were fully discussed previously. Basically, the amendment was at their at the request of the sponsor and the Multnomah Commission. And the amendments basically simplify the language. It removes certain aspects of the original bill and adds some clarifying statements. Section 1, a paragraph is added stating that the budget document may include an amount equal to the payments that are due for the current and subsequent fiscal period, excluding the amount of property tax that is needed to pay bonded indebtedness. That was an addition. The bill itself adds things like that as well. It adds the requirement that the document could include how much would be owed to repay the district's bond obligations, pension, and disability plan obligations. It requires that the municipal budget increase estimates in order to account for anticipated constitutional limits, tax discounts, and the failure of taxpayers to pay their taxes when they are due. It applies beginning on or after July 1, 2007.
Okay.
we have anyone signed up to testify at Paul?
We're in a work session.
We're in a work session, yeah. And so there was any...
Department. Right. The department's here. Deborah.
Deborah?
A
non-property tax person is here. Let me get
all right. We'll stand at ease for a few minutes.
And there is no revenue impact for this one, Mr. Chair.
On Senate Bill 808.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. I'm not sure what bill you're on, so...
Oh, Senate Bill 808. Sorry about my voice.
That's okay. I've had a chance to look at that. I don't really have any comments unless you have specific questions I can try to help with.
It seems very straightforward. We just had our staff run through the major summary.
Yes, we think it's more of a cleanup bill. It just helps clarify certain situations where districts are involved in unique levying circumstances because of the bulk biennial levies, and I think it's just kind of a housekeeping thing for us.
Very good. Thank you. Any questions?
Yes, I carried a bill a week or so ago that dealt with districts that are moving to a biennial budget and that pass a bond, mm-hmm. and they want to be able to start levying toward that bond during that biennium and not have to wait till the following biennial budget. And it passed the Senate pretty substantially. How is this different, and how does this add to it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this has some other aspects, too, and it has to do with certain unique situations that Multnomah County faces because they, and some other counties that don't have an appointed county clerk, I mean, they have an appointed county clerk, they don't have another clerk, or they don't have a clerk position at all.
Okay.
So the law requires that the budgets, and this has to do with local budget law, which is in Chapter 294, all local governments, the 1,500 local governments, have to comply with budget law. The law requires them to send their budget to the county clerk. Multnomah County is one of those counties where they don't know where to send it. It just ends up in the assessor's office. They forward it around the building.
Okay.
And so that's one of the housekeeping issues. It's very simple but it's a problem.
So this says in Multnomah County it would go up to TSCC?
Yes.
Yep. So makes sense to me.
Let's see. The other issue in the bill has to do with requiring certain levies that are expressed in dollars be calculated a certain way. This is a carryover from before Measure 50. You know, in the olden days, there was such thing as a tax base, and that tax base naturally grew by law, by Constitution, in Article 11, by 6%. And that's the way it worked. And so the law was crafted in such a way that local governments would build their budgets to determine the amount of revenue they needed, offset by the amount of revenue they had or expected from other sources, and then they would determine the amount they needed, and then they would back into their tax levy, and a rate would be calculated. Well, Measure 50 changed all of that, and so now, basically none of the districts, I mean, the assumption that they might be able to levy more than they need is kind of off the table for most districts. It's the more reality now is that they could, anything they can levy, they need. And so the formula for determining your levy is totally backwards now. And the law didn't keep pace with that. So if you read the formula, you won't get to a very good solution in what Mr. Linares has brought up, the director of the Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission, with this bill, is to accept the realities of that turnaround and to realize that it's particularly difficult for dollar levies, not rate levies. So I don't know if that's helpful at all, but Mr. Linares is here also.
Would you like to speak to it? And also, you guys are comfortable, or you are the author of Dash Ones?
Vice Chair George, members of the committee, yes, my name is Tom Linares, the director of the Multnomah County Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission. Essentially, what we're trying to do with this bill, in this section of the bill, is write the statute to correspond to what districts are already doing under Measure 50 in terms of calculating how much they're going to receive in property tax levy, in property taxes, and as a result, what their property tax levy will be to raise that amount, because it's been written incorrectly since 1997. I wrote the language, submitted it. sent the language down to the Department of Revenue, the assessment taxation unit, which oversees local budget law for the state, and they had some suggestions in how to make the language clear and more precise. That suggestion is in the Dash 1 amendments.
Mr. Chair,
mm-hmm.
I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 808.
Any objection to the Dash 1 amendments? So moved.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved that Senate Bill 808 as amended be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? The clerk will call the roll.
Linda Burdick.
Excused.
She is.
Karen
Torres.
Aye.
Senator Monroe.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Excuse. Thank you. Senate Bill 808 as
first one to carry.
Oh, that will be. I'm assuming Senator Johnson. Okay, it's her bill. Okay, I'm sure she will. All right. Well, Senate Bill 808 was then referred to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and we will stand at ease for a few minutes until the rest of our committee returns. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 609 and tell us about the bill.
Mr. Chair and members, Senate Bill 609 deals with ESD funding, and it would also require the formation of a frontier education outpost by intergovernmental agreement among the Grant, Wallowa, and North Central Education Districts. It specifies various duties for the outpost and would require each member to spend at least $10,000 per year for outpost operations. The second part of the bill would be to increase the minimum amount of funding for an individual ESD. Currently in the statutes is $950,000. That was reduced from $1 million by the 2005 legislature when the funding level for ESDs went from 5% of the combined school district and ESD funds to 4.75%. The bill would increase that back to the $1 million. The bill came from Senate Education. You have a letter from Senator Walker, and you also have attached to that two amendments that the committee had that the Education Committee had presented to it, but that they forward for your consideration.
Okay. Laura, would you like to have everyone come on up? Three, we'll do three at a time. Happy to hear from you. Oh, here's David. Senator?
Right.
Yeah. We waited, and we almost waited too long.
Oh. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Nelson, State Senator from District 29. I cover four counties out there. The distance from one end of the district to the other is about 200 miles. Similar to the distance from Portland to Seattle. I just say that to indicate that this bill, I think, indicates the issues that these folks have out here is distance. In the last session, there was a lot of talk about ESDs and consolidation, and these folks out here, these three frontier networks, took that to heart. And so they came up with a very innovative, creative plan, and trying to aggregate the resources and increase capacity in the interests of delivering better services to the students. They're getting a mixed message, basically, from the legislature, because now all of a sudden they've come up with this plan, innovative plan, and now all of a sudden there's resistance to it. And there's a monetary issue, I guess, involved, but it's, I don't know, Steve probably has a better idea of what that's all about, but it's... the original bill, there was really no impact on the state fund. I think with the Dash 2 and the Dash 3 amendments, there is some impact, and I'm sure he'll be able to tell you a little bit about that. But in the whole scheme of all the money that's being spent in the education budget, it's not very much. And this is a situation where these three frontier networks basically rely upon local resources to fund their programs. And it will have some impact on some of the other ESDs, but... This group of folks felt that they were directed by the legislature in the last session to go and figure out some ways to be creative, and they've come up with some ways to be creative. Now they're finding resistance, so they're getting a mixed message. One of the folks you'll listen to is Ed Jensen, who is from Wallowa County. That's the one county that's in my district. And I was just involved with a hospital program. They built a state-of-the-art hospital in Willamette County. So what he does, when he does things, they're successful. And so I have a great amount of faith in what he's trying to do here, and have a respect for him, and I would ask that you listen to those folks, because they have the details on how this thing really works. But, you know, they're trying to respond to what the legislature's telling to them, and all of a sudden they're getting mixed messages. So I would appreciate the committee's attention and listen to their story. Thank you.
Thanks, Senator.
Yes. Yeah, what's the generation of the Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments? Are those yours, or?
It's really coming from this group, and they can better explain them.
Okay.
I think they're more supportive of the Dash 3. Is that correct? That's correct.
Okay.
That's
okay.
What that's to my notes, okay. Senator.
I would just pass the note, and I am so sorry that we are in this position, that we're supposed to be at the floor at 10:15, but we all know that things won't happen until a quarter till. So we would ask you to come on up quickly and tell the story about this. You know.
And we'll have to have staff call the floor and get us excused.
Can you do that? Yeah. These folks come along.
A little longer, yeah.
All right. You guys know the drill. State your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rolf Myers. I live in Condon, and I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 609 with the Dash 3 amendment. Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Monroe, in answer to your question very quickly, the reason that the Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments were generated had to do with the fact that when the original concept was drafted in legislative council, the issue that had to do with the funding formula with respect to tax revenue funding was missed with respect to getting into the original original 609 bill. So we had to go back and have that amended. Now, in the interim between
not the first time it's happened.
Well, it was certainly understandable. We understood why that happened, because there was quite a rush right there at the end, as you folks well know. The Dash 2 amendment was introduced, I believe, on behalf of the OAESD, the Oregon Association of ESDs, and provided $1 million floor for all five of the Frontier ESDs, and that would be North Central, Grant, Wallowa, Lake, and Harney. It did not allow for our unique proposal, which has to do with tax revenue funding of the three fiscally unique ESDs, which are North Central, Grant, and Wallowa. We then introduced the Dash 3s, which incorporated our tax revenue funding and $1 million floor for Lake and Harney. So that's where the Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments came from. I want to take just a minute of your time, and I won't take very long because I understand the time is compressed. I think it's notable that, as you're all aware, but I just want to put some numbers on it, that the folks who came here today to testify on this bill, by the time they get home, will have spent over 100 hours on the highway and 4,000 miles to get here to testify on this bill. The total amount of money in play, and by that I mean the difference between the funding that they get now, which is roughly $935,000, and the funding that we are proposing with tax revenues, is the total amount of that money in play represents 0.6% of the total amount of 2007 to 2009 K-12 funding. So it is truly a negligible amount of money. And with that, I also want to say very quickly that the decision was made. Some of you have some institutional memory with respect to the Frontier Internet Network, and some of you do not. When this decision was made to fully support Senate Bill 609, we made the very difficult decision to not go after reinstatement of the Frontier Internet Network funding. The Frontier Internet Network was passed in House Bill 3298 in 1999. It was originally passed at $950,000 a biennium, and has been reduced each biennium since then, and in fact has been eliminated from both the governor's budget and the co-chair's budget the last three sessions, and we have been successful in getting it reinstated because it is a fundamentally good idea. We made the decision, and I reiterate that it was a very difficult decision to make, that we would not go after that $500,000 per biennium funding because we felt that it would compromise our chances at Senate Bill 609, and in the long run would be more beneficial, 609 would be more beneficial to more kids in Eastern Oregon than the Frontier Internet Network was. And believe me, that wasn't easy. We just laid off three teachers last week. And I'll tell you right now that in our area, in Gillum County, which is where those teachers were based, laying off three teachers is equivalent to laying off 1,000 teachers in Multnomah County. That's the equivalent economic impact. With that, I'll close. I do want to say one more quick thing, is that Senate Bill 609 with the Dash 3 amendments has no negative perceptible impact on any other student in this state. And that's evidenced by the fact that OSBA, COSA, OSEA, and OEA are all neutral on this bill. Because it's a genuine benefit to students, to kids, to children across the state, particularly in Eastern Oregon, with no perceptible negative impact on anybody else. So you have an opportunity today, I think, if you pass this bill, and we ask that you do, to acknowledge the fact that Oregon has an obligation, a solemn obligation, I would suggest, that each child, regardless of location or by accident of birth, is entitled to basic education. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
These mics are really sensitive. They work best if you stay about a foot to 18 inches away. You don't have to get up on top of it.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. My name is Noah Cleaver. I'm superintendent in John Day, Grant School District, and I want to thank this committee for allowing us to speak in behalf of Senate Bill 609-3. It is about kids, and in Grant County, I have to get back to a board meeting this afternoon still, and my time has been taken up discussing cuts. We're into our second round of cuts as a result of two things: loss of students, and, of course, the federal forest fees money, which went away. So we're devastated by those cuts. In the 35 years that I've worked in Eastern Oregon, in the four counties in Eastern Oregon I've worked with, during that time I have constantly encouraged the ESDs to look at ways to pool their resources to maximize those dollars for kids. Mm-hmm. Finally, we have three ESDs that are willing to come to the table and say, we can do a better job for kids if we pool our resources. Even though my student population is dropping, my special ed population is not dropping. My high needs kids are not dropping. And the ESDs play a critical role in serving those high need population students. It's about kids. 609-3 provides a way for us to hire instructional assistants for special ed kids that we otherwise will not be able to do. And that's a requirement that's put on us by the state and federal government. So if we do hire those people, it will be at the expense of another program somewhere else. So I would encourage you to take a real earnest, hard look at this and understand that it is about kids in our school district, and I thank you for your time.
My name is Edward Jensen. I am the superintendent of Wallawa ESD. Thank you, Senator George, for allowing us to speak this morning. Senate Bill 603 would help us by allowing us to provide a single point of contact to ODE to disseminate information to and from ODE. A problem which ODE has stated in the past that they've had is because there's been too many ESDs and there's too much information to give out. We are willing through this bill to provide that as a single point of contact, which means that we would give them all of the budgets, we would give them all of the data information they need for schools, would be held responsible to this new outpost that we're talking about through the agreement of the 190. It also gives us an ability to move forward together to share staff through the 11,000 square miles that we're talking about for 2,700 students. It allows the ESDs to continue to assist schools in meeting new graduation requirements in math. Somebody says we don't have to teach calculus. We might have two calculus students for the whole county. We might only have five, but yet and it's difficult for us to find those kind of people for each school. But we're hoping through this process we would be able to meet those needs of those kids. And also to help us to meet the other requirements that legislature determines for schools to meet. And the federal government, again, you know, you've all heard the stories of federal forest fees and how it's going to go away and the tremendous impact it's going to have on the counties. I'm not going to address that. It's the new changes in the law of special education that is going to probably make it almost impossible for school districts in our area and in the other two ESD regions to collect certain special ed funding because we won't be able to show the excess in cost, which is a misleading situation because we have tremendous costs, but when you only have 100 students in a school,
the overall cost per student is very high, so you don't meet some of that federal requirement. RESD spends all of its present funding, as does Grant and North Central, to meet the present needs in technology, special education, speech language therapy, physical test, psychological testing, excuse me, curriculum development. And the only thing that we really do for the schools themselves that doesn't directly impact kids is that we, like in our particular ESD, we do all of the physical, accounting, and business services for all of the school districts. We're at a standstill. We have done everything that we can with the resources we have. We want to move forward to help students, and the only way we can do that is through the innovation of Senate Bill 609-3. I would really like you to take the time to consider the validity of 609-3, because it's very, very important to us to be able to move forward. We could stay here all day and tell you all the problems we have. It's not going to cut it, because you can't solve our problems for us. But you can give us some tools that will allow us to solve those problems ourselves. We certainly aren't going to expect you to solve all our problems for you, because if we were, I'd have been down here at the very beginning of the session. But this is one way that we can address those problems locally and find local solutions for them. And I want to thank you for your time. I know you're extremely busy.
We're ready for another panel. Randall Anderson, looks like we're going to get the chair back. Bradley Royce and Anthony Lanny and Laura, if you'd like to come on up too, we can have you guys seated there. We are looking, they're advocating Dash 3, you're probably aware of that. And this is these three.
And we called the Senate floor to excuse us till 10:45.
They never start.
Okay, that's what we said too.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Randall Anderson. I'm a member of the school board at Enterprise. I've been on the school board since about 1990, I think. And I'm here. Mr. Royce and I left Enterprise at 1:15 this morning to drive down here to be able to testify. So, Mr. Chairman, you didn't hear the last person's testimony, and he covered many of the points. And I guess my biggest push is that the quality of our school depends on healthy, viable, ongoing support from the ESD. They provide the things that we cannot do individually. They provide the special education, that's counseling, the testing, and in Mr. Jensen's example, perhaps a shared calculus teacher that all of the schools could use. What we need is a method, a tool, so that we can retain the tax money that the people in Willow County spend and use it for the kids in Willow County. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Brad Royce, Superintendent of Schools and Enterprise. As Mr. Anderson said, we got up 1:15, and the reason we did that is for kids. And it's not about empathy or sympathy or anything else. We're here because of the kids of Eastern Oregon. I'd like to go on record as stating that I hope you will support Senate Bill 609-3. It's a bill that brings parity to the students of the school districts. I have two pages of stuff that I was going to do, but I'll highlight the key things here because in the absence of time. I do want to challenge you to take a look at what happens with kids in Willow County and Eastern Oregon. We have the best test results in the state. We feel like we have a quality education program. And what 609 means to the students and the kids of Eastern Oregon is parity with other districts and that are larger and more populated. We've had a 50% reduction of staff in the last 6 years in our school district alone. We're on the upswing. We're getting some programs back, but we won't be able to get anywhere near parity without your support of Senate Bill 609-3. With Senate Bill 609-3, we'll be able to add some technology programs. We will be able to maybe comply with the law and special ed and IDEA. We'll be able to bring back art and music that were cut in the last round at a limited level. Our alternative ed programs will be reinstituted. And our goals are to hopefully increase some of the requirements that we have for math and sciences. And one of the biggest problems that we're running into in Eastern Oregon is to try and get highly qualified teachers. And so 609 would provide lots of funding for the ESDs to help us get that. We don't have a problem finding teachers, just get them highly qualified. And so that would help us in that realm, and it's a huge problem in Eastern Oregon. So we appeal on your sympathy, if nothing else, the fact that we got up here to testify before you after driving all night. And in my book, this Senate Bill 609-3 is all about kids in Eastern Oregon. Thank you.
How are you, Senator Deckert, Chair Deckert, and members of the committee?
Pull the mic over.
Oh, I'm sorry.
There you go. I'm a little excited. I just wanted to give you, I have been involved in the ESD. My name is Anthony Lanny. I'm the superintendent of North Central Education Service District and Grant Education Service District. I have been involved in ESD and legislative issues since for the last six sessions. We started with three small ESDs, and we consolidated. We went from Sherman, Gillum, and Wheeler ESDs to one ESD called North Central ESD. We've worked steadily with our three counties to try and make things better for the kids. Our Frontier Learning Network provided volunteer all of our medical personnel. Ambulance personnel are volunteers. We don't have any paid ambulance people, so they need to be trained, and the Frontier Learning Network was a vehicle that trained those. We're going to have to find a way now, absent the Frontier Learning Network, to train those people. We've seen our funding be cut by 70% over the years. We whined a little bit, but not a whole lot. And we've tried to work to provide things for our students and provide a system that's viable. And this program of the three of us working together increases our capacity so that we can help these kids. It's getting very desperate in Eastern Oregon. It's a wonderful place to be if you don't have to live there. I mean, it's fun to go out and drive around and hunt and fish and do those kinds of things. But to make a living in Eastern Oregon is not easy. Part of the reasons we work so well together with the counties is that's the only way we can get things done. We're basically tapped out, and we're here to ask you for help. I believe this is an innovative program. I believe it can be successful with the people that are involved. We'll increase capacity, we'll increase teacher training, and we'll increase help for students. And I thank you so much for listening to me. And I wish I were a better public speaker.
That was terrific.
Very passionate.
Yeah. Well, sometimes the best is just...
Thank you very much.
Questions for this panel?
Oh, excuse me.
Thank you for getting up at 1:15 in the morning. I was up at 1:15 for other reasons. Kid who won't sleep. It's a worse reason than coming to the Capitol. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Judge Pryor.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for taking the time to hear us today. I wanted to just hand out this map to you because I want to try to orient you on why this is such a problem economically. What the map is that you are going to see, I hope you're going to see this a lot because this has become almost my Bible in trying to talk about what's happening to the counties in Eastern Oregon. This map shows you in the black area all the public land owned in the state of Oregon. The white area is what's privately owned. It's 38% of the land area. Now, here's the worst news. 91% of that, and this is by LCDC's numbers, 91% of that 38 is zoned ag or forestry. These gentlemen that were here talking to you have their hands tied in terms of generation of wealth and an economy that can grow and flourish. because if it's zoned ag or forestry, it's reasonably static. You're not going to have that churning of your economy that can drive your the revenues into these schools. So what we're asking you for now with this bill is please allow these ESDs to have the money that is generated from the people that tax themselves. Almost every one of these ESDs that you see here, people tax themselves far higher. In Gillum County, it was $46 a thousand before Measure 5. So their hands are tied in terms of what they can do. So what we're asking you to do is please let these very rural frontier communities that tax themselves, let these ESDs keep that money and let them use it in their schools. Please do that. And I want to thank you very much for hearing us.
Thank you, Judge Fryer. And I'll, for the first panel that I missed, I'll stay after the committee, after we adjourn here, and meet with the first panel since I missed them. Questions for Judge Fryer? Just one that comes to mind in terms of taxing. Have you tried a local option where then you're able to, I know Pendleton passed one, but tried a local option and then you're able to keep, obviously, all the local revenue that you pass on top of the state allocation?
No, I don't think that's been done yet.
Okay. And we're now getting the maps. Other questions for Judge Pryor? Okay. I will stick around if the group has time to meet.
Senator, thank you for hearing this bill.
You bet. We will, anyone else on Senate Bill 609? Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 609, and we are adjourned until Thursday at 8:45 when we have the biofuels package up tomorrow morning. We're adjourned.